So as I said, Daniel's been there in exile, and he's been reading his Bible. That's a good place to start, isn't it? He's been reading the books, he says in verse 2, and he's come to understand that God had said through Jeremiah that the exile would last 70 years. And we're told in the first verse of Daniel 9 that this now happens in the first year of Darius, who's now king over the realm of the Chaldeans. And so Babylon has gone, and the empire of the Medes and Persians is there now, and Darius is their new king. And Daniel has been in exile now for probably 68 years. And so Daniel's doing his maths and realizing there shouldn't be that long to go. Probably Daniel was a teenager when he went into exile. And he's now 68 years older than that. So he's probably in his 80s. And he's been given prophecies too. We've looked at some of them before, chapter 2, chapter 7. And some of those have started to come true with the passing of the Babylon Empire and then the coming of the Medes and Persians. And so Daniel begins to pray about these things. And Daniel receives an answer. Did you see that in verse 20? While he's praying, an answer comes. Gabriel, the angel we've seen before, we looked at that last week. The angel Gabriel comes with a message that he wants Daniel to understand. Verse 23, consider the matter and understand the vision. So Daniel's been praying about the 70-year exile, and now God sends Gabriel with another vision. And on the first reading of it, it's not the easiest part of the Bible to be working through this morning. Perhaps you can realise why I switched it with next week. We'll do Daniel's prayer with the children next week, but this I thought probably was a little bit tricky to do with the children with us. This prophecy here that might be called Daniel's sevens. There is this word that keeps coming up, these weeks. But the real word in it is a word just meaning seven. What's going on? Daniel's been praying about the return from exile, which should happen after 70 years. And God comes with a message about the next 70-somethings, at least. God's going to tell him the next bit, too. And so the word we have in our New King James, weeks, is a translation from what they've got there. In Latin, it's heptad. A bit like the word we have heptagon for a seven-sided shape, or a heptathlon for a seven sports. A heptad is a seven-fold period of time. Now, a week is one of those. A week has 7 days. The Israelites also observed every 7 years, or they were meant to. Every 7 years, there was meant to be a Sabbath year when the farmland was left to go fallow. So they were meant to keep this count of seven, something that was quite important. Here we don't know exactly what it means, unlike that prophecy to Jeremiah, which did say 70 years. Here we don't have the word for certain. So it can be a little confusing. But it's important for us to try and see some of the wood for the trees here and see that actually what Daniel is being told is a wonderful message. Remember how it starts in verse 23. The command has come out, Gabriel says, and I've come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. This is a message from God to Daniel via Gabriel, because Daniel is loved. The purpose is not to confuse Daniel and to throw him into turmoil. The purpose is to bring him help and comfort from a loving God. And so that's important for us to bear in mind. What we're going through this morning is not some academic exercise to stretch our minds, but hopefully something that brings us that message from a loving God who loves his people. It's important for us to realize as well in the Bible that the number seven is sometimes used in a symbolic way. It comes up quite often in some of the prophecies and things like that. This sort of picture of it being a perfect number, that sort of thing, a complete number. And that's the sense in which we're going to work with it for the time being. So for the title this morning, God's Perfect Timing. the reason, in the first instance, all these sevens keep coming up, because that's the perfect number in the Bible. And God wants to tell us about his perfect timing. Verse 24, 70 sevens are determined for your people and for your holy city. Here's a message for Daniel, because he is loved, and this is all determined. This is all known by God. This is all in his mind, and he's going to carry it out. It's a plan for his people, for the city. It is God's plan that he's now revealing to Daniel. Maybe Daniel was praying, as we've been saying, about the end of exile, thinking that they're going to go back from exile, back to the land of Israel, and everything would be back to normal. I think in many ways what God is showing him here in this passage, in this prophecy, is yes, you are going to go back from exile, but it's going to be the start of a new chapter. I'm going to tell you these new things that are going to happen in the next 70 sevens, says God. So let's see what's going to happen. Those of them are quite short sentences, so hopefully we can work through them and see a bit of what's going on. So, in 70 sevens time, however long that is, we'll worry about that for a minute, what's going to happen? Verse 24, to finish transgression, to make an end of sin, to make reconciliation for iniquity. So something is going to happen at the end of these 70 sevens. And he lists these three things to start with. Transgression will be finished. Sins will be ended. And iniquity will be reconciled. Well, that's some big words there, isn't it? There's three words we've got for sin, for starters. Transgression is kind of when we deliberately rebel. Sin is a little more of a lesser word in a sense. It's not quite as intentional. Sin is when we fail. When we fail to do what God requires. Whereas transgression is when we do it quite deliberately. Sin's when we fail. Iniquity is more about our roots. That in our nature we're a bit twisted. And so iniquity comes from the inside. It's not just about the things we do. It's a bit of a problem because of who we are. So we've got these three words, transgressions, sins, and iniquities. And the good news is in 77's time, Daniel's told, something's going to happen that's going to fix that. Transgression will be finished, sins will be ended, iniquity will be reconciled. The news surely is the good news that God is going to finally and fully deal with sin. Transgression, sin, iniquity, doesn't matter what you call it, God's going to deal with it. God's going to fix it. God is going to do something to bring it to its end. And in the last one, to bring peace. That's what reconciliation is. That there's going to be peace between human beings and God, which couldn't exist before because of their sin. And yet something's going to happen. That's what we're being told. In a certain period of time, something's going to happen to bring peace. So that sinners can have peace with God. So there's three things so far that are going to happen. Let's carry on with them. Then number four, working still through verse 24, 77 is determined to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Well, let's go with the next two for a minute. Number four, then, the fourth thing that's going to happen is everlasting righteousness is going to be brought in. That kind of fits with the others, doesn't it? Sin's going to be done away with, but it's not just that. Then righteousness is going to be brought forth. And that's a good thing for us sinners, isn't it? It's not just that we've been forgiven to leave us sort of neutral before God. I don't know if at school you still get negatives for doing something wrong. Well, those are sort of minus points, aren't they? Well, a teacher might say, well, I'm going to take away your negatives. What does that leave you with? Nothing. It leaves you with zero, doesn't it? If they've taken away the negatives, you're just left on zero. But God's going to do more than that. He's not just going to leave us neutral, forgiven. He's going to make us righteous. He's going to bring in righteousness. Fifth thing that's going to happen, vision and prophecy is going to be sealed up. That is, that it's going to finish. Vision and prophecy will be completed, fulfilled, finished. The last one's a bit tricky, come back to that in a minute. But all of those, perhaps, I hope we can see, with our New Testament eyes, in a way that perhaps Daniel couldn't, we can just read those things, and once we sort of think through what they're meaning, we of course think of Jesus, don't we? How, when else could those possibly happen? If not through Jesus. We read those things and we look at that list and say, that must be talking about the coming of Jesus. Or at least the finishing of his work, that he's going to end sin, he's going to deal with the problem, he's going to make us righteous before God, he's going to fulfill the visions and prophecies. Well, that sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? We see these things completed by him. The sixth one is a bit ambiguous, to anoint the most holy. The most holy what? It almost seems like we're sort of missing a little bit. It's a little bit puzzling, isn't it? It could refer to a place. The Jews referred to the most holy place. Is something going to happen that's going to anoint that? Or it could, of course, refer to a person. The anointed person in the rest of the chapter is the same word as we get for Messiah. So it could be talking about a person too. But maybe there's a little bit of ambiguity on purpose. And Jesus kind of uses the same thing, doesn't he? Once, towards the end of his life, he's talking with some of his enemies who are causing him trouble and asking him tricky questions and things like that. And Jesus says to them, destroy the temple and I'll build it again in 3 days. He's bringing those two. He says, destroy this place and I'll build another. But he's not meaning a place, is he? He's meaning himself. Because Jesus is the place where we meet God, where we're reconciled with him. So perhaps you can sort of mix your words a little bit here in the same way as we think of Jesus. So Daniel's looking forward for the next 77s when all these things are going to happen. Now we, of course, are looking back, aren't we? We're looking back to this prophecy, but we're looking at it and going, oh, this is all fulfilled, isn't it, by Jesus. So that's the first step that we're going to work through. In some ways, verse 24 is fairly straightforward. I hope we can see that and be pointed to Jesus in those verses. The next verses get a little trickier. In some ways, it seems to me that Daniel's then splitting up the period of time. If you can see that, there's 77s up there on the screen as a timeline. If the youth want to draw their own timeline with this, they can at the bottom of the page. And Daniel then sort of sees it split up into different parts. There's going to be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, middle of verse 25. So there's going to be 7 sevens, that's phase one. Then there's going to be 62 sevens that come afterwards. And if you do the math, then of course there's one last seven to come at the end. So there's now 3 periods of time that are going to be described for us. So God's perfect timing, phase one, the 7 sevens, verse 25. Know therefore and understand from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there'll be 7 sevens, 62 sevens. The street will be rebuilt again and the wall, even in troublesome times. So phase one seems to be that there's going to be a short phase right at the beginning, 7 sevens, which is going to come with the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And there might be some troublesome times that follow. That seems to be talking about Ezra, Nehemiah, people like that. And the return from exile, the rebuilding, plenty of trouble, they've had too. Then there's phase two, these 62 sevens in the middle. We're not given much detail here, it's almost passed over particularly. It's then in verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, we're barely told anything that's going to happen. In this chapter, it seems mostly to be they're going to wait. There's these promises of the Messiah, but they're going to have to wait. We've seen some other prophecies already, haven't we, in some of the other chapters that Daniel's had, that talk about the comings and goings of various empires in the middle. But here, there's this period of time when they're going to wait. And then there's going to be the last seven, heading into verse 26. After 62 weeks, Now we are in this last seven. That's the 62 and the seven before. Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. So, in God's perfect timing, the Messiah is going to come. And the Messiah is going to be cut off. So in some ways, we've had six things that are going to happen. Here's the seventh. The Messiah will come. Another one, eighth one. The Messiah will be cut off. Now, that sounds a bit weird to us. But to the Israelites, they'd heard the same sort of thing before in prophecies. Isaiah 53, which again gives a very detailed prophecy about Jesus. We'll come back to that later. In Isaiah 53 and verse 8, we read that he was cut off from the land of the living. To be cut off means to die, means to end. So the Messiah is going to be cut off, but not for himself. The Messiah is going to die, but not because he deserves it. He's going to die not for himself, but, well, implication is for others, isn't it? So that's going to happen. Verses 26 and 27, a little bit puzzling, but let's just move on to 27 for a minute. He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he'll bring an end to sacrifice and offering. So the Messiah will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. What could that be talking about? Well, it might be those verses we just read for our communion service. Matthew 26, verse 28, Jesus said, "This is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many." Same words as here. Jesus is going to bring in a new covenant, and he's going to confirm it. He's going to tell them it's happening. He's going to declare it to them, and it's a covenant now that's for many. Even more than might be thought of before. It's going to be a covenant for many. Then in the middle of the week, he'll end sacrifice and offering. Well, again, we might see again a fulfillment of that in Jesus. That as Jesus dies on the cross, what happens? The temple curtain's torn in two. And as you go on into the New Testament, the writers there will talk about that finished sacrifice of Jesus. Because he offers the real sacrifice and there isn't any need for any more anymore. Like in the book of Hebrews, for example. He's the Lamb of God who's taken away the sin of the world. So these things seem to happen. And again, we can sort of try and piece things together in a bit of a tricky passage. But see, they said, well, that must be talking about Jesus, mustn't it? And there's so many links to things in the Gospels that we're told about him. So all these things are going to happen when the Messiah comes. The things we had before in verse 24, and then these things we've added to here. Then it's a bit weird, though, isn't it? He talks about this is going to happen. We've been happily talking, well, sort of, about these weeks, about these sevens. And then he says in the middle of the seven, he's going to do this. That's kind of splitting up the time a little bit, isn't it? I wonder whether the last week should be split in two. So all these things are going to happen, and then maybe we've got a little bit of a phase four right at the end. Because some of the other things don't sound quite right, do they? From our New Testament point of view. Look in verse 26. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood, till the end of the war desolations are determined. Now that doesn't sound quite like what we read of happening at Jesus' death, does it? That doesn't quite fit. It seems to be talking about something else. It's talking about the city being destroyed and the sanctuary, that's the temple, being destroyed and a people coming, a prince coming against the city. That sounds a bit different, doesn't it? Or right at the end of verse 27, on the wing of abomination shall be the one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Well, again, that's a little bit of a puzzling set of words to work through. But Jesus quotes it in Matthew 24 and verse 15. Jesus is talking about the fall of Jerusalem. And he's talking about the time when armies will come against them. A bit more of that in Luke's version of the account. And in Matthew 24 verse 15, Jesus says to them, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel standing in the holy place, then those who are in Judea should flee to the mountains. Jesus takes those words and says they're talking about the fall of Jerusalem. So we're going to take our lead from Jesus in this. And so there's probably a slight difference in the timing. Some of these things happen with Jesus as he dies and rises again and does all these things that we've been thinking of, finishes that work of salvation. And then some of them are slightly delayed here, as Jesus is saying in the gospel, to talk about the fall of Jerusalem. And those things would happen then in AD 70. There would be those same sort of things. The Romans would come and destroy the city and the temple. And they would put in this abomination in the temple courts themselves. So the prophecies do all come true in it. I think we can see most of it being fulfilled in Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension into heaven. But other things a bit later as well. Let's just pause for breath a minute. That's a lot of stuff to digest a little bit, isn't it? Of this funny little timeline we're given here. One thing just to think of for a moment is to sort of crunch the numbers, I've said. Some people try and get it all to fit very nicely. And lots of commentaries and lots of, sometimes you might hear things on YouTube or whatever, and they try and make it all very, very simple and almost set it out like we have got a very precise timeline. And so they say, well, if these sevens refer to 7 years, then you can do your seven times table, not the easiest one. And so the first period should be 49 years. The second period should be 434 years. And then you've got, if you split it, 2 3s and a halves at the end. Ooh. And that makes 70 sevens or 490 years. Now, sometimes people try and work very hard to get everything to work exactly. And it does sound nice, especially perhaps the 3 1/2 over here. That's about right for the ministry of Jesus, from his coming to his, from his start of his ministry to his death. That sounds great. That fits nicely. The other one doesn't seem to fit at all. The 3 1/2, then it to the fall of Jerusalem, it isn't. It's about 30. So that doesn't work really. And then people try and, it's a bit difficult, because at the beginning bit, it referred to the command going out to rebuild Jerusalem. The problem is, in the Bible, there's at least three of those. There's Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. You might know some of those characters. And there's almost 100 years from start to finish. So it's a little bit hard to work out which one we're talking about, which rebuilding scheme, to make all the numbers fit. And sometimes it seems to me that people are doing a little bit of, shall we call it, historical gymnastics, to make it all work. What I reckon instead is they're approximate numbers. Seven is the perfect number that they thought of. We perhaps don't use it like that, but we do have other numbers we do play a little bit fast and loose with. We use the number decade, don't we, to refer to, you know, something in that region of time. We refer to the 70s, the decade when, you know, music was revolutionized, whatever. Or we refer to, into our own English history, to the Century War with the French, which wasn't. But we use the numbers roughly, don't we? And I think that's what we should do with this. That the numbers are there not to give us a precise timeline, but to give us this sense that it's God's perfect timing, and he knows exactly what's happening, but maybe there is a sense for us to follow it through approximately. In the New Testament, nearly an end now. In the New Testament, we have this wonderful verse in Galatians. We did a Christmas service on it a couple of years ago. Can't remember when exactly. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, we read this. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. When the fullness of time had come. I think that's what Daniel's talking about, using these perfect numbers to talk about that God's got this plan, and when the time is exactly right, when everything has worked out exactly as God wanted, God will send his Son. And he's going to bring about this plan of salvation to ransom his people, to redeem them under the law and adopt us as sons and daughters. He's going to do it in just the perfect time. And maybe if we were going to put it in an English way, thinking of our decades and centuries, it is approximately 5 centuries Daniel's meant to wait. And the funny thing is, when you turn to the New Testament, which is approximately 5 centuries later, what do you find? You find people waiting. End of last week, in our sermon in Daniel, we ended with Christmas. Because Daniel has a lot of Christmas links in a funny way. And here, just to finish off with the Christmas thought, because it's only a few months to go. In Luke chapter 2, Mary and Joseph bring Jesus, the little baby, into the temple. And they meet a man called Simeon. And Simeon, we're told, is waiting for the consolation of Israel. And he says, I've seen your salvation, the light that will bring revelation to the Gentiles and glory to your people Israel. And then in the temple we're told there was another, Anna, a prophetess who was a great age. And she had not departed from the temple but served God there. And coming out in that instant, she gave thanks to the Lord and then spoke of him to all those who waited for the redemption of Jerusalem. You get the idea that people are waiting. Christmas is coming. Jesus has just been born. And there's God's people who've been doing a rough count and are thinking all these prophecies that God gave to Daniel, they must be almost here. And they're waiting on the edge of their seats, as it were, for Jesus. There's one more as well. In Matthew chapter 2, we read of Magi from the east. And they're watching the stars. We sometimes touch on their story at Christmas, but they're a very bizarre group of people. We've got not the foggiest idea much about them in the New Testament who these people are, except in the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, you'll meet people called the Magi. They're Nebuchadnezzar's band of wise men who watch the stars and think about visions and prophecies. And 5 centuries later, you've still got a few of them. And it seems to me, it's a guess, it's only a guess, they've been reading Daniel. And that might give them the hunch they need to go following a star, looking for the king of the Jews. Because the fullness of time has come. And those who've got the eyes to see it are looking for the Christ who's going to come. For us, of course, the timing's different. We're looking back at all of these things. And yet, hopefully there's something for us here as well, as we see God's perfect timing in everything. That should be something that helps us in our faith in our lives too. And to see here in the Old Testament, Daniel the Beloved, God calls him. He's given this precious message of the coming Messiah. And in some ways, we mentioned before Isaiah 53, most people would turn to that to think of the clearest Old Testament prophecy about what Jesus is going to do. I think it probably is. I think second, it's probably Daniel chapter 9. Here we're told what the Messiah is going to do. It's spelt out for us. His saving work on the cross. It's no accident. These things Jesus talks about, the way that the gospel goes out into all the world, it's all these promises being fulfilled. So we see it fulfilled in Christ. These things we've been reading of this morning, which are told in a shadowy sort of way in the Old Testament, in a slightly obscure and puzzling sort of language we've got. But we can look at it with the spotlight of the New Testament shone on it and go, wow, this is telling us of Jesus. Jesus, the one who's ended sins and finished transgressions and made peace. Who's given us righteousness, who's fulfilled every prophecy, who is the most holy. And the one who's come, the one who was cut off, not for himself, but for us. The one who's brought about a covenant that he's given to many. This is Jesus, the one who's finished sacrifices and offerings the one who's done it all. And so we come to remember, as we've done this morning, that finished work of Jesus that was prophesied before, and that in God's perfect timing, it was all done. And so it should give us reason to rejoice, shouldn't it? To see here these things that were planned, that have been fulfilled for us in Christ, that we might rejoice in all that he's done for us and know that everything else in the future is he's going to work out in the same way of his perfect timing. So as God's people, we don't need to be afraid. We're like Daniel, we're the greatly beloved. And God has got everything under control. Just as he has the past, he's going to work it out all the way until the return of the Lord Jesus as well.